As America moved into the 19th century, it did so as a fully print-based culture in all of its regions. Between 1825 and 1850, the number of subscription libraries trebled. What were called mechanics and apprentices libraries, that is, libraries intended for the working class, also emerged as a force for literacy. In 1829, the New York Apprentices Library housed 10,000 volumes, of which 1,600 apprentices drew books. By 1857, the same library served 750,000 people. Aided by Congress's lowering of the postal rates in 1851, the penny newspaper, the periodical, the Sunday school tract, and the cheaply bound book were abundantly available. Between 1836 and 1890, 107 million copies of the McGuffey Reader were distributed to the schools. And although the reading of novels was not considered an altogether reputable use of time, Americans devoured them. Of Walter Scott's novels, published between 1814 and 1832, Samuel Goodrich wrote, "The appearance of a new novel from his pen caused a greater sensation in the United States than did some of the battles of Napoleon. Everybody read these works, everybody, the refined and the simple." Publishers were so anxious to make prospective bestsellers available, they would sometimes dispatch messengers to incoming packet boats and within a single day set up, printed, and bound in paper covers the most recent novel of Bulwer or Dickens. There being no international copyright laws, pirated editions abounded with no complaint from the public or much from authors, who were lionized. When Charles Dickens visited America in 1842, his reception equaled the adulation we offer today to television stars, quarterbacks, and Michael Jackson. "I can give you no conception of my welcome," Dickens wrote to a friend. "There never was a king or emperor upon earth so cheered and followed by the crowds and entertained at splendid balls and dinners and waited upon by public bodies of all kinds. If I go out in a carriage, the crowd surrounds it and escorts me home. If I go to the theater, the whole house rises as one man and the timbers ring again." A native daughter, Harriet Beecher Stowe, was not offered the same kind of adoring attention, and, of course, in the South, had her carriage been surrounded, it would not have been for the purpose of escorting her home, but her Uncle Tom's Cabin sold 305,000 copies in its first year, the equivalent of 4 million in today's America. Alexis de Tocqueville was not the only foreign visitor to be impressed by the American's immersion in printed matter. During the 19th century, scores of Englishmen came to America to see for themselves what had become of the colonies. All were impressed with the high level of literacy, and in particular, its extension to all classes. In addition, they were astounded by the near universality of lecture halls, in which stylized oral performance provided a continuous reinforcement of the print tradition. Many of these lecture halls originated as a result of the Lyceum movement, a form of adult education. Usually associated with the efforts of Josiah Holbrook, a New England farmer, the Lyceum movement had as its purpose the diffusion of knowledge, the promotion of common schools, the creation of libraries, and especially the establishment of lecture halls. By 1835, there were more than 3,000 Lyceums in 15 states. Most of these were located east of the Alleghenies, but by 1840 they were to be found at the edges of the frontier, as far west as Iowa and Minnesota. Alfred Bunn, an Englishman on an extensive tour through America, reported in 1853 that practically every village had its lecture hall. He added, "It is a matter of wonderment to witness the youthful workman, the overtired artisan, the worn-out factory girl, rushing after the toil of the day is over into the hot atmosphere of a crowded lecture room." Bunn's countryman, J.F.W. Johnston, attended lectures at this time at the Smithsonian Institution and found the lecture halls jammed with capacity audiences of 1,200 and 1,500 people. Among the lecturers these audiences could hear were the leading intellectuals, writers, and humorists, who were also writers of their time, including Henry Ward Beecher, Horace Greeley, Louis Agassiz, and Ralph Waldo Emerson, whose fee for a lecture was $50. In his autobiography, Mark Twain devotes two chapters to his experiences as a lecturer on the Lyceum circuit. "I began as a lecturer in 1866 in California and Nevada," he wrote. "I lectured in New York once and in the Mississippi Valley a few times. In 1868, I made the whole Western circuit, and in the two or three following seasons added the Eastern circuit to my route." Apparently, Emerson was underpaid, since Twain remarks that some lecturers charged as much as $250 when they spoke in towns and $400 when they spoke in cities, which is almost as much, in today's terms, as the going price for a lecture by a retired television newscaster. The point all of this is leading to is that from its beginning until well into the 19th century, America was as dominated by the printed word and an oratory based on the printed word as any society we know of. This situation was only in part a legacy of the Protestant tradition. As Richard Hofstadter reminds us, America was founded by intellectuals, a rare occurrence in the history of modern nations. The founding fathers, he writes, were sages, scientists, men of broad cultivation, many of them apt in classical learning, who used their wide reading in history, politics, and law to solve the exigent problems of their time. A society shaped by such men does not easily move in contrary directions. We might even say that America was founded by intellectuals, from which it has taken us 2 centuries and a communications revolution to recover. Hofstadter has written convincingly of our efforts to recover, that is to say, of the anti-intellectual strain in American public life, but he concedes that his focus distorts the general picture. It is akin to writing a history of American business by concentrating on the history of bankruptcies. The influence of the printed word in every arena of public discourse was insistent and powerful, not merely because of the quantity of printed matter, but because of its monopoly. This point cannot be stressed enough, especially for those who are reluctant to acknowledge profound differences in the media environments of then and now. One sometimes hears it said, for example, that there is more printed matter available today than ever before, which is undoubtedly true. But from the 17th century to the late 19th century, printed matter was virtually all that was available. There were no movies to see, radio to hear, photographic displays to look at, records to play. There was no television. Public business was channeled into and expressed through print, which became the model, the metaphor, and the measure of all discourse. The resonances of the lineal analytical structure of print, and in particular of expository prose, could be felt everywhere. For example, in how people talked. Tocqueville remarks on this in Democracy in America. An American, he wrote, cannot converse, but he can discuss, and his talk falls into a dissertation. He speaks to you as if he was addressing a meeting, and if he should chance to become warm in the discussion, he will say, "Gentlemen," to the person with whom he is conversing. This odd practice is less a reflection of an American's obstinacy than of his modeling his conversational style on the structure of the printed word. Since the printed word is impersonal and is addressed to an invisible audience, what Tocqueville is describing here is a kind of printed orality, which was observable in diverse forms of oral discourse. On the pulpit, for example, sermons were usually written speeches delivered in a stately, impersonal tone consisting largely of an impassioned, coldly analytical cataloging of the attributes of the deity as revealed to man through nature and nature's laws. And even when the Great Awakening came, a revivalist movement that challenged the analytical, dispassionate spirit of deism, its highly emotional preachers used an oratory that could be transformed easily to the printed page. The most charismatic of these men was the Reverend George Whitefield, who, beginning in 1739, preached all over America to large crowds. In Philadelphia, he addressed an audience of 10,000 people, whom he deeply stirred and alarmed by assuring them of eternal hellfire if they refused to accept Christ. Benjamin Franklin witnessed one of Whitefield's performances and responded by offering to become his publisher. In due time, Whitefield's journals and sermons were published by B. Franklin of Philadelphia. But obviously, I do not mean to say that print merely influenced the form of public discourse. That does not say much, unless one connects it to the more important idea that form will determine the nature of content. For those readers who may believe that this idea is too McLuhan-esque for their taste, I offer Karl Marx from The German Ideology. "Is the Iliad possible," he asks rhetorically, "when the printing press and even printing machines exist? Is it not inevitable that with the emergence of the press, the singing and the telling and the muse cease, that is, the conditions necessary for epic poetry disappear?" Marx understood well that the press was not merely a machine but a structure for discourse, which both rules out and insists upon certain kinds of content and, inevitably, a certain kind of audience. He did not himself fully explore the matter, and others have taken up the task. I, too, must try my hand at it, to explore how the press worked as a metaphor and an epistemology to create a serious and rational public conversation from which we have now been so dramatically separated.